Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. What if artificial intelligence was able to solve a murder? Used to find locations and sift through public data to ping where you were on a given day, a given time. CyberCheck is an AI technology that claims it can help cops identify key evidence in cases. It was used to prosecute a man in Akron until the defense found an error in the report. Now law enforcement agencies across the United States, including Ohio's Bureau of Criminal Investigations, are wondering whether CyberCheck lives up to its promises. Joining us to talk about the case and the wider law enforcement implications is Wired contributor Todd Feathers. He covers algorithms, surveillance, and technology as a staff writer for Gizmodo. Welcome to All Sides, Todd.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start out with the facts of the case in this Akron murder. It's very sad. It involves where two people were shot at in their driveway. They survived, but a 20-month-old boy was fatally wounded. And the police were having trouble figuring out who did this. So how did they turn to this company called CyberCheck?
Pretty quickly after the shooting, police narrowed in on a suspect, a man named Philip Mendoza, and they were asking for the public's help by identifying two suspects seen shooting at the victims, and they obtained search warrants for Google and Sprint for subscriber information and phone information for Mr. Mendoza, trying to place him near the scene of the crime, on Fifth Avenue in Akron. And neither of those warrants placed Mr. Mendoza's devices near the scene on the day of the murder. And the investigation stalled for months and months until Akron police received help from a little-known Canadian company called Global Intelligence, which sells this product, CyberCheck. And CyberCheck produced a several-page report that appeared to place Mr. Mendoza's, what CyberCheck calls a cyber profile, it placed his cyber profile at the scene of the crime, supposedly on the day of the murder. Now, there's some issues with that report and the date that they actually put on there, which we can get into in a little bit. But this was, you know, kind of a key piece of evidence that preceded the Summit County Prosecutor's Office finally bringing charges against Mr. Mendoza in the murder.
So this is involving that 2020 case. CyberCheck essentially says for a fee, it does searches of all the public stuff available on the internet. But more importantly than just searching the internet, it is a Google search powered in the background by AI algorithms, algorithms that are looking for things faster, quicker, and they argue more thoroughly than a human investigator could. So how does it do that? Because one of the things that has come up in your reporting, and it appears in case after case, is CyberCheck is not sharing how it's doing that and whether maybe it's using some non-public sources. I guess we are having a little bit of a technical difficulty. So basically Todd's article says that one of the big, is he here? Hi.
I am. I'm so sorry for the sound issue.
Not a problem. So I was getting to this question that open source intelligence experts say that the kind of information CyberCheck is producing wouldn't be available from public sources, that it is not a souped up Google search powered by AI.
Yeah, so CyberCheck claims to do a couple of different things, and some of them are pretty common open source intelligence capabilities that nobody really disputes. It's possible to connect a particular person to their social media handle or to email addresses or forum account usernames, for example, using, you know, various techniques that open source investigators have been using for years. What CyberCheck claims to do, which is different, is to be able to geolocate a person's cyber profile either in real time or at any point in the past, very specifically to a location, by detecting, logging, monitoring when a device associated with their cyber profile pings a wireless network. So this might be the wireless router in your home or the wireless router in a business. And that is just something that the open source intelligence experts we talked to said is not open source data. Police and law enforcement can get that information if they obtain a search warrant for a wireless network's logs. They can get that information if they obtain a search warrant for a suspect's device. But you can't do that just by searching on the internet.
So is the question here, and this kind of is the crux of my question, is it a question of whether the AI is hallucinating, which is the word for creating fictional answers, or whether perhaps they are using non-public sources, which would constitute an illegal search?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. It's a question I don't have the answer to, and I don't think that courts have the answer to either. But I think there's also, it might be none of those options. So on the one hand, this is not an issue, I can say pretty confidently, of AI hallucinating, because CyberCheck is not claiming to use generative AI, which is the kind of AI that we hear all the talk about, all the buzz about right now, and it hallucinates. They say that they're using machine learning algorithms that, you know, sift through reams and reams of data to detect patterns, to tie particular accounts and devices to people in their cyber profile. What has happened in Ohio is the defense attorneys, and particularly defense attorney Don Malarchik, has been, you know, advocating on behalf of his clients to take a look under the hood of CyberCheck to get access to the source code, to these algorithms that the company says that it uses. And so far, even though Mr. Malarchik has been successful in getting a subpoena and had his experts review that code, they say that the code that they have been shown by CyberCheck is not anything like what the company claims it can do. That it's basically what they have seen is just a couple hundred lines of code that would run a program akin to performing a Google search, and no algorithms, no machine learning. So there's some really open questions about what role, if any, machine learning plays in this process.
One of the things that defense attorney Donald Malarchik found was a really interesting wrinkle in this case. It's that they had a time and a place that Mr. Mendoza, like, they placed Mr. Mendoza at the scene at the right time, the right place, but the wrong date. And then they got an identical report for the correct date. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. And so a key thing that CyberCheck claims is that their process is entirely automated, that police have access to the CyberCheck portal. They input information about their case into this portal. That information goes directly to the company's algorithms, that no humans working for CyberCheck or otherwise are involved, that this algorithmic system mines the open web, the dark web, any other sources to build a cyber profile and determine the suspect's location. And that once that process is done, the program automatically produces a report and submits it back to the police department. And so what happened in the Mendoza case is that the first report that Akron police received placed Mr. Mendoza at the scene of the crime, at the time of the crime, but 18 days after the crime happened. The shooting happened on August 20th. The first report placed him there on August 20th because the Akron police employee had incorrectly entered that date. What Mr. Malarchik found very suspicious is that at some point after that, CyberCheck produced another report that was identical in all respects. Everything about it was identical, from the time, the amount of time that Mr. Mendoza supposedly spent this location, except that the date had been changed. And there's really no explanation given for why that might be.
It's entirely possible. It could be coincidence, but it also, it's the kind of replication that would raise my eyebrows as a reporter, too.
Yeah, and the key question that has kind of dogged CyberCheck in Ohio and in other cases throughout the country that we found is that CyberCheck doesn't retain any of the data or the evidence that it says it uses to come to these conclusions. Police departments receive a report. It's usually a couple pages long. It has an accuracy score that is usually more than 95%. And it says this suspect is in this location at this time based on these wireless devices. But it's impossible, according to CyberCheck's founder and CTO Adam Mosher, who has testified about this in court, to go back and kind of follow the evidence trail, the trail of the data that, you know, put that suspect there at that time, that connected that suspect to that device. which makes it very difficult, and many courts have ruled, impossible for defense attorneys to challenge the use of this evidence.
I will say that Adam Mosier, who founded Global Intelligence, the company that created CyberCheck, repeatedly turned down your requests for interviews. But you had a lot of interesting data and facts about him. The one that got me was that outside of the testifying under oath that they don't record the data or how it draws these connections, so you can't go back and check it again, it was that he seems to have allegedly misrepresented the company's role in Canadian prosecutions.
Yeah, so this is based on court documents in an interview I did with a defense attorney in Colorado. And this defense attorney, Eric Zale, was representing a man who had been accused of possessing child sexual abuse material. He learned that the prosecutor in Boulder County, Colorado, was planning to introduce a CyberCheck report as evidence and to call Mr. Mosier as an expert to testify about it. And during a preliminary hearing, Mr. Mosier testified in that Colorado court that he had previously been qualified as an expert witness in two child sexual abuse material cases out of Canada. Mr. Zale, the defense attorney, hired a private investigator to look into that, and he ended up making contact with both of the prosecutors in these cases that Mr. Mosher claimed to have testified as an expert in. One of the prosecutors said he didn't testify in my case because he was related to the defendant, and the defendant actually pleaded guilty on the first day of trial, so there was no testimony given. The second prosecutor said the person that Mr. Mosher claims to have testified against was never charged with a crime at all. And both of those prosecutors ended up writing to the Colorado prosecutor and saying, we do not verify his claims. And the Colorado prosecutor ended up dropping all charges against Mr. Zale's client, the defendant.
That's pretty serious to be accused of having child pornography, having this guy saying this is proof that you had this pornography, and then there being all these questions about the legitimacy of it. That could really, if the accusation is false, it could really mess up the rest of your life.
Absolutely. And something that I found in looking into this is that CyberCheck, when police departments do use it, is not being used in, not to say that there are crimes that are less important than others, but it is not being used for misdemeanors. It is being used for murders, for child sexual abuse material cases, for cases that have obviously, very real and significant consequences for the people accused, but also for the families of the victims who expect to receive justice and, I'm sure would not want faulty evidence being used in a way that might jeopardize the receiving that justice.
Yeah, even in cases where it's been correct, sometimes it's hard for police to take action. There was a child abduction case by a non-custodial parent that you write about where it did accurately predict or prove that the mother and the child had been living in Oregon, but police couldn't act on it. She was later apprehended. She is in prosecution for abducting her kid, but it was right, but still police couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, and that comes back to this issue that I mentioned before of CyberCheck not retaining any of the underlying data or paper trail for its conclusions, is that police need to present probable cause in order to obtain a warrant, especially in this case where it was South Elgin, Illinois police, and they would have wanted to obtain a warrant to search properties or locations or information for somebody in Oregon. They need to have a good reason and be able to justify to a court why they're going to do that. And simply having a piece of paper that says, with 90%+ certainty, this computer program has determined that the person is here, simply is not enough.
Is there any thought, is CyberCheck even considering the idea of possibly retaining that trail, helping police trace those steps, get those warrants, or is it just, do they think keeping that kind of data is not possible, not feasible, not profitable?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to speak for what the company is doing or planning to do in the future. What I can say is that Adam Mosher has testified that it would be impossible to retain all of the data that his program searches because it is, in his words, zettabytes of data. And a zettabyte is 1 trillion gigabytes, which is
a lot of data.
Incredible amount of data.
Yeah.
Yes. Which to me, raises questions about whether the program is actually capable of sifting through all of that data. But certainly, if that is the case, it would make it very hard to retain and put in a comprehensible package all the data that has been sifted through.
It feels very Minority Report to me in a way. I don't know. It's not, I guess, before you've committed the crime, but it's very, perhaps Big Brother is the better analogy, that anytime you walk past somebody's house and they have a wireless network, is it pinging it for possible service and therefore tracking where you go day to day, minute by minute?
Yeah, and I think one thing that's really important to note here is that even though this particular product, CyberCheck, seems to have some very serious issues of credibility, that some of the capabilities that it is claiming to do, to be able to track people based on their devices, national spy agencies and police departments actually can do in other ways. One of the key ways they do this is through purchasing what's called bidstream data. And this is data that digital advertisers obtain about all of us based on our online activities and cell phone use that allows them to target us with very specific ads. When we walk into a Walmart, we receive an ad for a product that we previously viewed online at Walmart, for example. And there are companies out there that have repurposed this information without obtaining warrants in order to track individuals for three-letter government agencies. But that is not what CyberCheck is claiming to do here. And they expressly said that they do not use bitstream data. So I wouldn't want anybody to think either that they're constantly being tracked by the wireless routers around them. I also wouldn't want folks to think that it's not possible to track people based on your devices and online activity.
Feels like a good reason to turn off the Wi-Fi part of my phone when I'm not at home or work.
Yeah, I think we could all do some good privacy hygiene if we sat down.
That was Wired contributor and staff writer for Gizmodo, Todd Feathers. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Elon Musk's hard pivot to Trump. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today's second topic is Elon Musk and his unprecedented effort to re-elect Donald Trump as president. He's having million-dollar giveaways open to people who sign his Political Action Committee petition. His PAC is getting out the vote for Trump. And he's even moved his head of operations to Pennsylvania with plans to show up at people's doors himself. But Musk wasn't always so politically motivated. Here to talk about the evolution of Musk and other tech titans influencing this race is Ryan Mack, a New York Times reporter based in Los Angeles, who covers corporate accountability across the global technology industry. Welcome to All Sides, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about how Elon Musk has changed in the year 2024. So in the beginning of this year, he was a Ron DeSantis guy, but a more quiet, more behind the scenes supporter. Is that fair?
That's fair. He had that Twitter space with, or X space with Ron DeSantis, where he launched the Florida governor's campaign. That was in 2023. Obviously, when Ron DeSantis dropped out, he was a little less clear on who he was supporting. He didn't publicly endorse Donald Trump. Behind the scenes, though, he was meeting with plenty of other Republican donors, trying to discuss how to elect someone like Donald Trump. And then following the assassination attempt in July, he publicly posts his endorsement on X.
And now he is living and door knocking in Pennsylvania. Here he is stumping for the former president.
I think with a Trump presidency, we're going to get secure borders. We're going to get safe cities. We're going to get sensible spending. We're going to get deregulation. So we have sensible regulation, and we can unlock the power of the giant that is America.
So he's all in for Donald Trump this cycle.
He is definitely all in. At this point, he is talking with Donald Trump multiple times a week. He has committed already $75 million to pro-Trump super PACs, including one, his own, America PAC. And he is posting about him incessantly on X. If you just go to his X feed these days, it's all about registering to vote. It's about his giveaways, which we can talk about later. It's about why you should support Donald Trump, essentially.
And let's talk about why he supports Donald Trump, because your reporting was fascinating. I think one of my favorite characterizations, and I'd love to get a little more into it, was the description mm-hmm. of Elon Musk as the protagonist of his own science fiction novel.
Well, it's one of the key ways of understanding him. You know, he is the hero of his own story. He believes in these existential crises that, you know, are affecting society, and he needs to be the one that solves them. You know, in the past, that was things like reliance on fossil fuels, which is why he has run Tesla the way he has to electrify vehicles. It's why he believes, you know, humans should be multiplanetary, for example, and that's why he has created SpaceX. And in this instance, he believes that this is going to be the last free election if Donald Trump doesn't win. And so he is placing all his time and energy into electing Donald Trump. There are various reasons why he wants to do that. He has concerns about things like immigration, for example, the debt crisis, or, you know, the spiraling national debt, which he has talked about in that clip there. But personally, he is also pretty, he himself is under various government investigations. There's a lot of scrutiny from regulators on his companies. We had a story out this weekend about that. And he has a vested interest in making sure that that potentially decreases if a Donald Trump presidency does happen.
Yeah, he's had opinions on regulation of cryptocurrency, which the Biden administration and our own Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown has been at the forefront of. There, you know, we've seen regulators go in and put off deals because they say the mergers are too big and create monopolies. The Biden administration is taking a hard look at tech, everything from social media to cryptocurrency. And it sounds like Musk and some of his other friends in Silicon Valley would really prefer if people didn't do that.
Yeah, if you look at his companies alone, we've totaled at least 20 federal investigations or inquiries into Tesla, SpaceX, and him personally. You know, he has talked about running this so-called government efficiency commission with Donald Trump. It's something he proposed just kind of at will in an interview that he did on X Spaces. And it doesn't take a person very long to see how that's a massive conflict of interest. You know, this is going to be someone who potentially oversees government spending, oversees government hiring, and those regulators are the exact ones that are looking into his companies.
Would he have to, this may be a question outside your wheelhouse, but wouldn't he have to divest if he was going to go work for the government?
That's what the experts say. But it would be so unprecedented that it you know, I don't know if we have an example of that, of someone that kind of connected. Yeah, I mean, supposedly so, I guess, yeah.
We'll have to see. So yeah. Musk has a PAC, It's called America PAC, and there are different estimates about how much money it has raised. Some put it at $140 million. I believe Trump at some point has claimed it's close to $500 million, but it's a significant amount of money that Elon Musk and other tech billionaires are putting into this PAC, correct?
Yes, correct. And he has delayed in putting his money, or at least he didn't put it up front. He kind of wanted to not show up on the disclosure forms and waited to give his money. But thus far, he's given $75 million. Of course, there are other people that he has brought in to give money. And, you know, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars at this point.
And a recent opinion by the Federal Elections Commission allows Trump's team to use them. And I find this really fascinating. I mean, this is a little wonky and in the electoral weeds, but essentially he's allowed to share data, the Trump campaign and this America PAC, and use it to coordinate on get out the vote efforts, particularly in states like Pennsylvania.
Correct. And that is a new wrinkle that we see this election cycle. And that's effectively allowed America PAC to become the ground game for the Trump campaign, you know, where that wasn't allowed in the past. And so when you see this canvassing effort, when you see this knocking on doors, that's all funded by the America PAC, particularly in states like Pennsylvania, where Elon Musk himself has gone to do rallies and knock on doors and, you know, talk to potential voters.
I want to talk a little bit about Elon Musk on Twitter, or X, as he calls it. So he owns the company. He has 200 million followers, I believe. So he has a big platform on X. And he's also shared misinformation. He falsely claimed that Michigan has more voters than citizens. Here's Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson.
It's very concerning, in part because, you know, this is a significant platform. And gosh, I wish that folks with such large platforms such as his would use it to spread accurate information about our elections. I understand the nuances and the challenges of doing that. But if you have enough time to Google me and look up my middle name, which he clearly did, you should be able to find out the facts of our elections.
He also shared misinformation about Haitians here in Springfield, Ohio. It is fascinating to watch him share these pieces. And because he owns the company, I mean, you can't exactly report him for spreading a falsehood.
No, and I feel like a couple months ago I was on the show talking about our book, and, you know, we were talking about how far he has come. He has gone so much further at this point. You know, every day he is engaging with misinformation, lies, essentially. And it seems to be kind of nonstop at this point. You know, you talked about the Springfield thing, for example. This morning I just checked his feed and he posted something about Barack Obama supposedly repealing something he did not repeal. And there's a community note on that tweet. So this has become a regular occurrence for him on his own platform. You know, I think of something as well as him sharing a deep fake. Well, not a deep fake, but a AI-generated photo of Kamala Harris, for example, dressed as a communist. You know, that was obviously fake and in violation of the company's own manipulated media policies. But, you know, he is just going to run through those rules, even if he is the owner of that platform, or because he's the owner of that platform.
Yeah, that book that came out in September, if you're curious, is called Character Limit, How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter. And we're going to have to get a copy of it. I'd love to have you on to talk about it at more length later on this year, especially once we see how much of an influence Musk and America PAC really had on the election. Because in some of your reporting, there are traditional get out the vote canvassers and experts who are not sure this is going to work, whether it was essentially too little too late.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's been a lot of turmoil in the canvassing effort. Musk has already fired one company involved with the canvassing effort. He has hired different advisors to bring in. And that's all happened in the last couple months. You know, this is very late in the campaign cycle. I think a lot of that comes down to this view that he has that, you know, he can do things better than anyone else. He can come in, he can break things down into what he calls first principles, these ideas of, you know, why can't we do things this way? I'm going to ask questions along the way for everything and question everything. And, you know, he's gotten very involved in the nitty and gritty of the effort. You know, he's meeting with these folks sometimes every week, you know, talking about them, about their efforts. And that may, again, be too little too late. Like, this is very late, and we're what, 2 weeks away from the election. And, you know, they're still kind of chopping and changing at this point. But it shows to the extent that he is involved in the efforts.
I wonder if Trump wins Pennsylvania, arguably he's very likely going to win the White House. I wonder to what extent Elon Musk and America PAC will get the credit if that turns out to be how things go on Election Day.
I mean, I feel like he'd love to take the credit for sure. I mean, again, we go back to this idea of him centering himself as the hero, and he has placed his money there. He has placed his time. He has spent the last couple of days going around the state, you know, speaking with voters, doing rallies. He has these giveaways now. So, yeah, of course, he's going to take all the credit.
Musk is not the only tech leader that you talk about in your reporting. You also talk about Peter Thiel, who embraced Trump in 2016. He also is largely responsible for the candidacy and election of Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. And it's interesting to see how Thiel, Vance, Musk, they all come from a certain kind of Silicon Valley philosophy, and it's really become a major part of the Republican platform now.
Yeah, I mean, this is the new donor class, essentially. These are the folks that, you know, are propelling the Republican Party forward. Peter Thiel recognized this in 2016 when he first supported Donald Trump, you know, at a point where very few people were doing so in that election cycle. And J.D. Vance is one and the same. He is someone that worked for Thiel. He was his venture fund was funded by Thiel in some ways, and he was given his start by Peter Thiel. And Thiel gave him about $15 million, or his super PAC, or his PAC, $15 million in his Senate run, and that has propelled him to where he is now.
Mark Cuban is one of the biggest names supporting Harris from this field, but he isn't providing the same level, or really any level, of financial support. Why do you think Cuban is lending his name but not his money? I mean, I know that's a hard question to ask.
Yeah, I'm not sure with Mark Cuban. I mean, I know he's been very public in his views on Donald Trump and the folks that are backing him. I guess you'd have to ask him himself. But he's always been an interesting character. He's always been very outspoken.
What is the Democratic response? What is the Harris campaign response to this very active push by a certain segment of the tech sector?
I mean, they've pointed it out. They've also run ads to the effect of, you know, showing that this is the new Republican donor class. This is where they're drawing their power from. These are the billionaires that are trying to influence the election by doing this. I think at this point, Kamala Harris has answered plenty of questions about Elon Musk. I just saw a clip of her talking about, you know, the $1 million lottery that Musk is running as well. And she's saying that, you know, folks are looking into it. Yeah, they have addressed it head on, and I think they'll continue to do so.
That was New York Times reporter Ryan Mack. His new book is called Character Limit: How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, what nutrition labels have to do with deciphering whether AI has created an image? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know,
Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. How do you know whether that picture of a presidential candidate, celebrity, or even that snowy mountain lodge are real? How can you tell when something's been generated by artificial intelligence? Right now, you have to become a bit of a digital detective, looking at hands and other small details to decipher a picture's authenticity. Adobe plans to change that, adding, quote, nutrition labels to the images we see on the internet. Here to break down what content authenticity is Russell Hawley, managing editor for commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, nutrition labels for digital images. Can you explain the analogy here?
Yes. So for a little while now, one of the common thoughts for how to detect whether something was artificial intelligence or whether it was generated by procedural tools was to ask the companies making those tools to watermark them as artificial intelligence. The idea there being that you could click a button and inspect an image and see that there was something saved in the data that indicated that it was created by an artificial tool. Not every company was interested in playing by those rules. And so Adobe has taken a different approach in that same kind of watermark tool in kind of the data that is associated with an image, using this app called Content Authenticity to serve one of two goals. One, to clearly indicate that it was something that was made by a person and indicate that artist so that it can be referenced within the image itself, but also to flag it as something that AI tools should not use to train their services. So when it's that nutrition label reference is really kind of the two bits there. One is, verifying that it's made by a trusted source, but also making sure that it is not to be used elsewhere.
And this was a feature that was previously embedded in Premiere Pro and Lightroom, but now it's going to be across Adobe's suite of applications and platforms.
It's actually further than just Adobe's platforms. This is something that previously could be used with just about anything as long as you had an Adobe subscription. Now the subscription is not at all required. Content Authenticity can be downloaded as a separate app. If you use freeware tools that you downloaded from the internet or, no matter what your situation is, if you have created an image, you can now pass it through this Content Authenticity app and have it watermarked in this way. So that it isn't being used to train artificial intelligence models.
I think it's really interesting because we also have AI podcasts emerging that we talked about that the other week, where it sounds like people talking. And we're, I think, as a culture hitting that point where we're really going to be asking, okay, how do I know what created this?
That's exactly right. These tools are going to become increasingly, more sophisticated and I don't know a person who hasn't received a phone call at some point in the last 2 years with someone that sounded very human when they answered the call, only to find out that they are not, in fact, human. So applying that on a broader scale is a challenge. And we're solving it for images now, but I think it may be a little while before we have also solved it for audio and video.
The other part of the tool that you referenced is it'll let creators opt out of their work being used in AI training databases. I think that's probably so important to the future of Adobe, just that creators have a way to feel like they can trust that what they're doing won't be taken.
It's really important, and it is something that applies retroactively. So if you are an artist who has a massive catalog of images and you're concerned that some of your art may have already been used in these training situations, you can pass all of that existing art through Content Authenticity. By republishing it, you are kind of reclaiming that ownership, as kind of silly as that sentence may sound.
Have the AI companies said whether they're going to honor this? Do they have to honor the nutritional label? How is that going to work?
Yeah, so I mean, that I think that ties into a lot of the legal conversations that are happening right now that would make it so that, does the New York Times, for example, have, complete ownership over the stuff that they publish? Or is this something that, while it's on the internet, can be used? As a part of this ongoing conversation, it's really important to know for a fact that that you have the ability to claim that this image or that this thing that I made is in fact mine.
Let's move on to hearing aids. So, in a couple of weeks, we could be sitting here discussing our hearing scores and how much hearing loss we have, how many concerts we've attended. So, Apple AirPods are getting a software update that's going to let all of us check whether we have hearing loss.
That's right. So, this is a software update that is going to come out to every iPhone, regardless of whether you currently own AirPods or not, over the next couple of weeks. And this bit of software allows you to, if you own AirPods currently, to perform a pretty rudimentary hearing test. Now, it's been made very, very clear by Apple when you first open the software, and in kind of other places that this is not a replacement for an actual hearing test that you would get with a professional. But the way that the AirPods work is you can put them in and run this test, and it will give you an output that you can do more than once to see how your audio, kind of loss has changed over time. So not super useful as like a one-off thing that you would do and then look down and go, oh, okay, I'm fine. But very much like the heart rate monitor for the Apple Watch and the blood pressure monitor for the Apple Watch, or rather the oxidization monitor. This is one of those things that's really useful over an extended period of time. So if you run this like once a month, then in a year, you'd have a pretty good idea of what your ear health was, within that period of time.
And potentially detect an early decline or the beginning of an issue.
That's exactly right. And then you can take that in, and this ties in very nicely with Apple's intent to take certain versions of its AirPods and set it so that the microphones behave slightly differently to accommodate for some of that detected hearing loss. So this is something that would allow someone who has certain levels of hearing loss to go in public and have nothing but AirPods in, which is fairly common these days, and not be associated with what is frequently described as stigma for someone who is wearing a traditional hearing aid.
They're also a lot less expensive than a traditional hearing aid.
They are also a lot less expensive, and there are certain, situations where this may be all you need for a little while. It would really depend on that conversation between you and the appropriate doctor.
So this is going to release next week. How do we know whether our AirPods are going to take this update, whether we're going to be able to use these kinds of features?
The short answer is if you have bought a new pair of AirPods within the last year and a half, you are almost assuredly ready to go. A lot of the things that have been made over the last little while have kind of already been sort of grandparented into this system. There are, if you have AirPods Pro, then those are going to work regardless of which version that you have. Apple has a posted list of which AirPods are going to be impacted by this, and a lot of the newer ones will work with this just out of the box. The software update will happen, and there won't be anything else you'll need to do on your end.
So, my AirPods are coming up on 5 years, so probably not
Those are
going to
probably
happen.
not going to work with this new system.
I also
But
feel like that's some kind of record for not losing them.
I think that must be some kind of record, because I certainly have lost mine far more frequently than that.
I have never lost a pair, knock on wood. But
Amazing.
I also color code my sock drawer, so it's probably just my personality.
Oh, that's a whole different conversation right there.
So, what I find also fascinating is when this hearing aid mode is on, your volume controls on the phone will change. You can also adjust the volume of the outside environment noise or the media you're playing. So, it has a lot of customization for any kind of user.
That's right. This is very much an extension of features that Apple had been working on specifically with the AirPods Pro for a little while now, where if you wanted to completely shut out the outside world, then it was kind of a quick button push. If you needed all of the, kind of environmental sounds to come in, for example, if you are a runner or a cyclist or something like that, and you are out on open streets, then being able to hear the outside world is very, very important. So having that kind of flexibility has been really important. But up until this point, Apple has very much had an on-off relationship with that functionality. And so being able to control exactly how much of that outside noise is, or being able to just quickly turn on when a very loud noise from the outside comes in to kind of protect your hearing from that, I think that's a great step forward in this progress that Apple had been making already with some of these headphones.
It sounds like the difference between a light switch and a dimmer switch.
No, that is a really great way of describing it. Yeah. And you've got kind of multiple dimmer switches at this point, including if you are someone like me who really struggles with hearing your own voice through like microphones, then, being able to kind of tweak it so that you are not hearing your own feedback is a really great feature to have.
Oh, that is cool. Maybe it is time for me to update my AirPods. Are other companies talking about doing similar things when it comes to hearing aid, hearing tests, or is this uniquely Apple?
Headphones have been something that Apple has really kind of led when it comes to some of these just kind of raw features that are added to these headphones. So it is likely that we will see Samsung and JBL and one or two other companies follow suit. It is unlikely that that is something that will happen until mid to late next year.
So, a U.S. district court judge in California pressed pause on making Google expand its Play Store to third-party apps. So, we've talked about this before, about the ongoing fight between Google, Apple, Samsung, and Epic Games. What's the latest?
That's right. So the last time we checked in on this, the judge had ruled in Epic's favor and essentially ruled that Google needed to open up its phones to allow third-party app stores to exist on the phone. So you would have the choice between getting an app from the Google Play Store or getting an app from either the Amazon Store or the Epic Game Store or something like that. And all that really means, as far as the user is concerned, is that the money that you pay would go to that third party instead of directly to Google. So for every purchase you make in the Google Play Store, Google gets a cut. And the difference there would be that this time Epic would get the cut instead. And that was the way in which it was determined that that was fair from a legal perspective for any company to be able to do this thing on Android phones. That was supposed to take place and be, kind of the rule that was in place according to the district court in California. It was supposed to take place this month. Instead, Google has appealed that decision, and it is currently traveling through the appeals court. And so this legal disclosure was an attempt to lift that ruling until this case had gone through the appeals process. And that was what was agreed on this week. So essentially, the ruling still exists, but it is not going to take material effect until it has continued its way through the appeals process.
Which could be a while.
It could be a long while. And I suspect that Google knew that from the beginning, and so did Epic, because these are two very large companies that have been fighting over this for quite some time. It is likely that we will hear more about this in the spring, when this case, kind of is set to go and get some additional information. But the important thing as far as people who own Android phones go, is that for the next little while, that material change that had been promised to how app stores were going to work is going to remain the same until this is ultimately decided by the appeals court.
And that ultimately comes down to how much you're going to pay for certain apps, certain programs, certain games. Because what Epic has argued is if we didn't have to give a cut to Google, we could give you a cheaper price, essentially.
That is exactly right. Epic has maintained for quite some time now that if you just bought stuff through Epic, then it would save you some money, because they can kind of pass on that savings to the consumer. That message has been muddied somewhat in recent times if you own a Windows computer, because a lot of the prices for some of those games have started to be exactly the same as some of the other stores, and it turns out that kind of reduced pay, all of that cut is going to Epic. So they are kind of flipping on what the original promise there was for some PC games. So there is some additional concern in light of that something similar would happen on phones and you wouldn't actually see long-term benefits from this.
Oh, so they would just collect more money.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it would end up, the kind of worst case scenario here as far as a consumer benefit goes is if the apps end up all costing exactly the same thing and all of this legal nonsense was so that you could give your money to Epic instead of Google.
And how is there any, does it, this doesn't directly apply to Apple or Samsung, correct? This is just about Google?
For the moment, this is about Google and anyone who works with Google, which does include Samsung. So Samsung's phones are run on the Android operating system, so it would end up being, kind of the same process here. What this ultimately means for Apple, Apple has maintained what is called a closed ecosystem from the beginning. So there was never an initial promise that this was something that other companies would be able to contribute to. Google made a very different promise when Android was first created. As a result, this process only applies to one of these two big competitors.
That was Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to say thank you to our All Sides staff. We have Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz. We have amazing intern producers in Kira Kadar, Chris Corcoran, and David Stein. Video production, if you're watching us online, is by the Ohio Channel. And we have board operation today by Cameron Howard. WOSU's Radio Chief Contact Director is Mike Thompson, and the program director here is the wonderful Amy Jurevich. You can like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram at WOSU All Sides. Thank you, as always, for listening right here on 89.7 NPR News.